And we're live with our 317th episode of Absolute AppSec. I'm Ken Johnson at CK Tricky on social media, joined by my co-host, Seth Law at Seth Law on social media. Seth, say hi.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to another episode. Ken and I are still recovering from San Francisco. I guess, you know, I have been back for almost a week at this point, but still feels like I'm still recovering, you know, given the amount of AI slop I had to consume for those, you know, few days. Heck, even the, you know, 2-3 days I was at B-Sides, or sorry, not B-Sides, at RSA. But before we get into that, Ken and I will be in Omaha next week at KernelCon. So we'll be there for, we'll be teaching Harnessing LLMs, updated version of our course. There are still a couple of seats available. If anyone is interested, would love to have you. This is a great opportunity to take that course. Like, honestly, I don't think we offer it at the same price anywhere else, just to be completely frank. This is one of the most inexpensive venues where you can actually do that. We do that to help support KernelCon and because there's good people that are there. So if you are looking for that opportunity, there is still some last minute seats available. On top of that, in a few weeks, we will be at DEF CON Singapore offering the DEF CON version of that course now with new skills and everything else that's going to go into that. Ken and I have been talking about updates. There are quite a few people signed up for that course in Singapore. But if you are going to be there, even if you don't take the course, let us know, because we'd love to see people, especially in the Asia region, right? I think we'll have some people up from Australia and other places. So we'd love to just do happy hour or whatever else during that time in Singapore. We will be offering that DEF CON course at DEF CON this year. That has been confirmed. We've also got Black Hat, the combo course of LLMs and secure code review that is going to be running at Black Hat as well. So there's other opportunities that are coming up. Keep your eye on training.absoluteappsec.com or follow us on any of the social medias or join Slack and we will post about it as those opportunities are available. Sweet. Okay, so that's kind of everything on the training front. I did want to talk through B-Sides. Let's separate out our experience from last week, right? Because this is always a different, an interesting one. And I did post a little bit about this on LinkedIn over the weekend after I got back, some of my thoughts. But let's start with B-Sides. In general, I mean, Ken, you and your team, you had a booth at B-Sides. So you were pretty ragged, let's be honest, right? Like trying to support everything and do the panel as well. But give me your thoughts on B-Sides San Francisco specifically. Like, how does it compare to other B-Sides? Like, what was your experience this year? How did you feel like things went?
A lot of good talks. That was actually like the downside of working at booth is there were just so many talks I wanted to see. So I think they just did a good job with selecting the material and content this year. Not saying they don't every year, but definitely particularly this year, I found myself really bummed that I was working, not bummed that I was working a booth. I'm grateful to have a booth. I'm grateful to have a company, but yeah, I would rather, I'd like to see the talks also. I don't know. Yeah. So that'd be the one thing. And then I guess, if anyone cares, I don't know if anyone cares about the vendor side of the house with booths, but if you do care, it feels like every year I'm watching them get better about how they strategically place food. I don't know why I'm telling anybody. I don't think anybody listens cares about this booth stuff. But if you do, they're getting better even about how they treat how they lay out vendors for better flow. Oh, hey, one other thing that was nice, Seth. I feel like they were a little less aggressive about hallway management this year, which was nice.
That's true.
It really does suck to get screamed at constantly just because you like stop in the hallway to talk to somebody. It's kind of ludicrous. It's like, well, you know, you have to, yeah, I understand people have to keep moving, but also there's just like a level of respect, mutual respect we should show each other, and screaming at people constantly about, you know, standing there for 30 seconds to say hi to somebody is ludicrous. And that wasn't the case this year. So I was really happy about that. And then what about you? Was there anything that stood out that was different this year than last year, or just anything that stood out?
Yeah. I'm with you on the hallway management stuff. It seemed to be better this year. I don't know if it was just like a change in whoever was running the hallway goons, for lack of a better term, right? Like the hallway management. That's always one of the big complaints at DEF CON as well, is some of the physical security goons get to be a little rough with attendees as opposed to, you know, being respectful. So it's a weird fine line to walk. Just the fact that we remember that from last year, right? Like, or the last couple of years is actually a negative thing. So kudos to the team for, you know, taking some feedback and realizing that, guess what, right? Yes, there is fire safety. There are people flow management issues, but let's be realistic about it.
That's the thing is I do remember it. And if I remember it, it means it was over the top. It means it was too much. So I'm glad they scaled that back. Did you see Larry's comment too about the talks? Sorry. You keep going. What else, Seth? What else did you? I don't want to ADD you. You keep going.
Yeah. Talk wise, I felt like it was really good. They've got really a really good selection committee. I think part of this is it feels to me like B-Side San Francisco is one of the premier B-Sides events. The number of attendees, the quality of the talks, the quality of the organization, the way they've handed it off, and they've gone through multiple different like iterations of management teams. Everybody seems to be on board, the volunteers that are there, right? Like that one and B-Sides Las Vegas are kind of the two premier B-Sides events, I'll be honest, right? Like they just very well managed. So I feel like they do get a higher quality talk count and research count, and people want to speak there, and so there is just kind of a different level of content as opposed to some of the smaller shows. And that's no dig on the smaller shows, it's just the amount of people that apply to speak and to do things at B-Sides San Francisco, at B-Sides Las Vegas, is probably much higher than a lot of the other B-Sides events. And so the committee that's choosing the talks, that's approving those, has more options, right? And can curate a little bit more than you can at some of these other events. And, you know, that's what it's going to be. It's going to be a little bit more polished than some of the other events. Now, that being said, to Larry's comment about beginners, he's absolutely right. Unless the team that is picking out the talks and approving them has a beginner track or has like that focus in mind, the tendency is going to be prioritizing new and novel research that isn't always beginner friendly. You will have talks like, you know, what comes out from Clint and some of the others where they do try to bridge that gap and to apply it to beginners in the industry. But overall, it's going to be harder to approach that. And I know Larry's got like, you know, he had younger members with him that probably it was harder to find some of that content that was appropriate for their skill level. It is going to be what it's going to be. Overall, I had a really good time. Always inspired by B-Sides San Francisco, inspired by the talks, inspired by our panel, even just having that discussion with Asta and Kevin and Clint. It's amazing, right? Like, it's really interesting to pick their brain on what they're seeing, because my view is so kind of scoped to third party that talking to someone that's embedded in an organization as big as Netflix is, right? Like that's a great thing for me personally, or even what Kevin's doing over at Superhuman, right? Awesome. So it was really good, right? Yeah, what stood out to you? I guess I want to ask that too.
Well, actually, now that you mention it, so it was cool to see Juan. It was cool to see Larry. It was cool to see Paul McCarty, Jen Guile, and there were Jerry Gamblin, and pretty much everybody that we know. Well, not everybody. Sorry. A decent percentage of the people that are fairly active in the Absolute AppSec community were there. So that was really neat to see in person. Also, I would say, like, the one thing too I forgot about this is that, well, I also wanted to mention the panel since you brought that up, but I also forgot about this on Saturday. The booth was for B-Sides, our booth was Saturday and Sunday. And then so on Saturday, what was weird is I remember at one point looking out, and right in front of me was Clint Gibler, Jason Haddix, John Hammond, Casey Ellis, Ariel Shin, Jen Guile, Paul McCarty, and I'm pretty sure like a few others. It was like AppSec, ProdSec, Sec, Royalty, you know, I was just like, it's like crazy. It's crazy to look around and be like, oh, Matt Johansson, you know, just a bunch of folks that I was like, I'm like all at once. And so that was basically Saturday. It was like, you keep running into these people. Oh, Lewis Arden from SemGrep, Leif Dreisler from SemGrep. I don't know, man. I saw a bunch of people. It was really cool to just catch up with everybody and have all those folks in one room. But I noticed Sunday kind of converted to like more students, I felt like. And, you know, obviously second half of the day filtered out. But I was going to go back to the panel. I think the panel was like really, really, I enjoyed it a lot. But what was really great was to hear all the feedback afterwards about how much people felt that it was relevant, like the questions were relevant. The panelists gave great answers, like very timely, you know, very true to life, very realistic answers. There was a mix of, I feel like, actually, you know, I'd say mostly, I don't know how you felt, but I think the panel was actually mostly optimistic. You know, there are certain things that we're all pessimistic about, but on the whole, it felt like, and I guess that's one thing I would zoom out for both B-Sides and RSAs. Like, I will admit going there, I kind of thought, I was a little worried I was going to go there and people are going to be like, I don't know, hanging their heads or kind of a little worried about like the industry, their job. Like, you know, I didn't know what the mood was going to be like. And actually what it ended up being was 180 degrees the opposite way. Like, I don't know how you felt, but from what I gathered from everybody felt, yeah, like there's things shifting and changing. And then there's a little bit of nervous excitement and energy around that. But ultimately it felt like everybody was very positive. Like, did you feel that? Or did you feel like there was more of a mix of the two?
It kind of depended on who I was talking to, right? There is a lot of positivity that's going into this on what we can actually do and how our jobs are going to change. But there's a lot of trepidation about what our jobs are going to look like. And maybe this is me just like, you know, my view and my tinted glasses right now on what we're looking at. Because it does feel, yeah, there's a lot of unknown that's, and we can get into it, right? Like, but I'm trying to think back to the conversations. I think it was more overall positive, more positivity than I was expecting about where we're at, especially with things like the layoffs that have happened and certain companies using AI as the scapegoat for cutbacks and other things. There is still quite a bit of positivity, especially for those that are in organizations that are utilizing it, that are attempting to, you know, push the envelope in the security space and in the ProdSec AppSec space specifically, utilizing AI. There's a lot to be said for that.
Can I make a comment on that?
Yeah,
real quick. I was asked. Somebody came around and put a microphone in my face, and they asked for predictions. And I've been pretty adamant recently that my prediction is that, you know, it's going to take 3 months, could take 6 months. But within that timeline, we're going to see a lot of like, okay, actually like trying to build your own solutions. Here's what you have to factor in. It's actually pretty hard. Like, it feels great at first, but here's what you need to expect if you're going to do this long term, like how to do rigorous evals and be very disciplined in your engineering, you know, how to do how to deal with cost management and outages, and also how to just learn how to orchestrate and drive these systems in an effective way, all these things, right? So I that was my prediction. All right. That was my, and I think I had even made a prediction that security is going to have to get way more disciplined in how they evaluate the success of what they're building, just because that's kind of like from day one the only thing that works to make these systems somewhat deterministic in outputs and whatever. All right, so I thought that was my prediction, and on the last day I had a meeting with a potential customer, and sure enough, it didn't take 3 months. They were like, we tried to build this, it cost us a fortune. Like the second we started to actually have problems, we tried to solve it with, you know, with money, with more, with better LLMs, with this, that, or the other. And they're like, yeah, I just ended up and doing more calls and doing more agentic work. And they're like, yeah, it costs us a fortune. It's not working well. And the work it takes to manage it is far beyond one person. I was like, you have one person managing that? I was like, what's your evals look like? They're like, yeah, we don't have anything like that. It's like, all right. Yep. And so this is my point, is like, I didn't even get out of RSA before that prediction at RSA came true. So now how public it'll be and what blogs and what material will come out, that'll be interesting. But anyways, I just thought that was interesting. It's interesting to have a prediction and then you don't even leave the place you had the prediction at and it came true.
So is that a prediction or or it's just what you're seeing now? Yeah.
Yeah, it's just weird. It's just, you know, you can pretty much guess these things and like just seeing anyways. So that was an interesting part of RSA. But the thing is, like, you left on Tuesday. So how much of RSA did you actually experience this year? Did you go down to the floor and look at the expos?
Oh yeah. Yeah. We did, right? Like so first couple of days, right? Like Monday, Tuesday. Granted, Monday is pretty slim, but I didn't leave until late on Tuesday, right? Like we took the last flight out. So we did the floor, talked to quite a few people. I hit kind of all of the AppSec traditional tool vendors on the floor and started to ask AI questions because that's what they're promoting. Every single booth on the floor was some sort of AI first or AI enhanced or AI RSA? is the RSA, right? Yeah. Like you probably, did you do the floor? I don't know.
I didn't go this year. Yeah.
that's a good choice. Right. But that being said, it's a good way to kind of judge the mood on what marketers and kind of executives are seeing, right? Because that is the lens that they view the security industry by. And so everything had, you know, oh, we're AI enhanced, you know, AI RAG, AI, whatever, generative AI, like it was all over the place. And so like I went and did a demo for Expo, right? I went and talked to those guys. It was interesting to go talk to your Sneak, your, who else? Invicti, Veracode, right? Like, at the SaaS scanners, Checkmarks had a huge booth, right? The amount of money that they're spending on promoting their new AI features. But the second that I start asking, okay, what is it that you're actually doing with AI? The booth representatives have a really hard time answering that. Typically have to go back to, oh, well, we got a technical guy that's over here. Comes down to, oh, we're doing some RAG. Oh, we're doing like, whatever else it is. Some people are approaching it properly, but there are the vendors, of course, like Expo that are AI native, right? Like they are utilizing AI from the very beginning. But then I also start to question what the pricing structure looks like on a lot of that because of the experience that I've had and you've had, like actually trying to instrument these things. And so like it was interesting. It's so overwhelming though, right? And I start to see where the money is actually going for a lot of these rounds, like the investment rounds.
Dude, I saw somebody say that on social media. They're like, I always wonder why people raise like $100 million. Like, where's that going? You know, like, how are you spending that much on your engineering? And I'm like, and they're like, not. I understand where that money's going. It's like, yeah, if a company raises like one of our competitors, just we're not even Series A. They're already on Series B. And they just raised another, I guess, I don't remember if it was 80 or 100 million. They just announced that they just raised. And I'm like, yeah, that money is going towards two things, branding and marketing and becoming the king in that way. And hiring a ton of salespeople doesn't really matter. You know, you're going to go through your churn, but you're going to hire an army of salespeople essentially and go to market to try and win. Yeah, that's where the money goes. Yeah. So
yep.
It's not for better engineering. It never is. Never is.
No. And it almost feels like you take that money and it's, you're forced into that path, right? Of, hey, we've got to be the name that comes up on everybody's lips the second that they start talking about generative AI or AI first, right? Like, and so I'm locked into what the product set is right now because I have to switch to marketing. I have to sell this product as quickly as possible so we can create our moat of like huge number of clients. And then we can either sell or we can either like bring others into it. As opposed to engineering, right? Like, yeah.
I will give something on the podcast. It's pretty privileged information. And so you wouldn't know this if you didn't. Basically, I sat in I had access to some executives at like the top companies that a couple of the top companies that are like the legacy sort of deterministic SaaS tooling. And what I can tell you is this is my fourth time as a dry run employee or founder or whatever at RSA. This is the first year that I can promise you, I talked to those folks. They absolutely know that the AI native approach is the right one and that they can't get left behind. So that's interesting to hear because, you know, I've heard so much resistance for several years now. I mean, that's all I've heard is resistance. And then now it's like weird to sit there with the top people in those companies and hear them say, yeah, no, we know, like, we know we got to pivot. We know we have to do something different. So there is an awakening even for the legacy products. I think their challenge is just that they, you know, we've talked about it before, you and I, they have clients with it's going to take time for some organizations to make the shift just because of their requirements being what they are, you know, big enterprise, pretty severe requirements that, you know, newer products breaking barriers they definitely aren't the right fit. But it is nice to just see the whole sort of industry moving that direction, but also just being kind of optimistic about how these new capabilities, you know, fuel the future. I think like one thing I heard over and over again was sort of the what about Anthropic and what about OpenAI? And it's like,
yeah,
every time we get into those conversations, like, okay, so you think given all the money, like forget all the other factors that go into it. And there's a lot. So like your consideration is that OpenAI and Anthropic are just going to become the de facto security companies, the two security companies in the industry, and just everything else we do goes away. Seems like a little bit of a crazy bet. Yeah, I don't think you take all that money and then, you know, our market's nice, but it's not the biggest market on the planet. So
no, anyways,
pure economic.
Well, and I did want to ask you about what happened with Anthropic and Mythos, like however you want to call it, right? Like that. This is hilarious to me, right? I'm going to be honest. Anthropic's, and I should find an article, but the release, the leak around Mythos happened because they basically didn't do basic security on endpoints like wikis and other things, right? Like I've got to find the actual article for it, right? But they didn't do basic security. Somebody found it, crawled it, realized that there was results out of a new model that they're developing with the code name of Mythos, right? Like everything else that goes into it, as well as results on how it's actually performing. But they didn't do basic security using their own tool on some of their own properties. And that's how they actually got exposed. Even though on the flip side, they're promoting all the code security stuff and they're just like not dog fooding across the board. And this always happens to organizations, right? But it still is entertaining to me. That's all. But the big thing that kind of came out of that after they like released and started talking about it is that the new model is going to be significantly more expensive than Opus. And that's the words that they used, is significantly more expensive.
Well, I mean, you have two ways of solving these problems, right? You can try and train a model on everything and try to like one gigantic model. It's very expensive and it you get incremental improvements. The other way is the agentic orchestration route, a lot cheaper, a lot more efficient. Also, you can keep things up to date a bit quicker. There are now, by the way, I did run into a company called Overmind, which I'm going to talk to once I'm off of PTO. This is like a little brief aside, but I met them at RSA. I was going with my co-founder to a podcast and doing that, and then on our way out, kind of bumped into them. And basically, their promise of their product is they will do real time. You can basically train a model that's running, essentially, a small language model, an SLM. Honestly, that's really, really interesting. That's a very, very like real time getting feedback and able to tune like a model is pretty awesome. So anyways, why did I go off on that? Oh, right. Back to the ways you solve problems. So yeah, you can have a very big, very expensive model. It'll get you, I don't know, 70% of the way there. You still have 30% gap. It's going to be very expensive. Performance sometimes on these models too are not great. So on top of the cost, you also have like the performance, but then also you have like still the 30% gap that you have to make up for, or it could be more. It just depends on the task, the type of thing it's doing, type of technology you're assessing, whatever. There's a lot of factors, right? So it could be more like 60% of the way there, and then 40% that you have to do. So I'm saying all that to say that, it's like every time I'm asked this question, I'm like, cool, if you want to pay $10 million just to get your PRs reviewed, fine, do that. If you want to, and your results will vary. Like you do need something over time that improves the more you use it. And there's many ways to achieve that, but just using some huge Anthropic models, not the way to get there. So I guess my point is, yeah, great. It's got better capabilities, but yeah, it's going to also cost a fortune. I probably won't even end up using it because it won't be as effective as some of the SLMs we can train. I don't know. It's just, I'm just not impressed with upgrades anymore. I'm just not. I'm like, every time they come out, I'm like, a lot of times in some weird ways they degrade. So what's the real benefit?
And this kind of goes back to the evaluations that you were talking about, right? Like you have to be able to compare, and you have to do performance evaluation on the models for the task at hand, right? And like I personally have seen this, especially on the dynamic side. Like it's great that there's these huge models that are trained on code, but that's not helping on some of the other tasks that I'm actually performing and what I'm actually doing and trying to build. And so I find myself going back to some of the open source models or some smaller models that give me decent results for
Faster, cheaper.
one tenth the cost. And I'm like, hey, if I can build a prompt that does what I need here, I don't need an Opus or a Sonnet, right? Like there's very appropriate times when I do need a reasoning model to build out like a full task plan and like need to, hook a bunch of things up. But most of what I do, that can be deterministic.
Right.
And
And it's
so
not
like
even hard to
it's what
tune or
I
train
do.
anymore. It used to be a lot harder. Now it's like simple. So it's like to your point, the open source models are pretty much getting to on par enough, cost a lot less, can do a lot, whatever, as much. Then you tune, and that's even getting easier to do. And like I said, this Overmind company even has real-time tuning. I don't see a world in which it's like,
So
what's
is yeah is
what
is
what is the
Anthropic
economics for
worth that
them?
money, right? Like yeah.
I guess ads. We're gonna just do ads now.
We're just gonna do ads. I mean, that's
You
what
want a
happened with
security scan?
Google. Yeah.
Okay, here's my new idea. If
New
you want a
prediction.
PR review, you can get your PR review scanned, but first you have to watch a 30-second ad on security training or hygiene or something like, I don't know, some kind of, I don't know, some kind of we're gonna figure out a way to monetize this security
Oh,
stuff.
yes, yeah. I'll build a Claude skill. You ask for within an organization every time that you run something, and however poor it is that you're submitting, right? Like the more ads you have to watch, right? Like
Exactly. If you're coding a lot, you're going to be watching a lot of ads. That's for sure.
that. We're gonna turn you from a yeah. We're going to turn you into a really revenue source.
Liberty Mutual after us, you know? You're not going to want to see another Geico commercial.
I'm pretty sure, like, didn't Cory Doctorow coin that term, right? Like the enshittification of, you know, cloud code or whatever, right? Like, there we go.
Yeah. Well, that's what we're going to do for security. That's our new mission, Seth. Let's just ruin it all.
Yeah.
I don't know, man. It's every time I get this question, it's like, well, what if they, the other one that's really fun is just the one where I get where it's like, well, what if it just writes secure code all the time forever? It's like,
oh man.
All right.
That'd be great.
I would love it for to just not write the same routine four more times and just realize that it in the same session had already written that routine. I'd settle for that. Or how about just not, you know, introducing basic SQL injection or command injection or IDOR or any of the things that I see constantly. It's like, yeah, I'm not worried right now. Maybe someday in some dystopian future, but let's keep our feet on the ground for the moment. So
yeah. How about that? Yes. I was looking back through Slack because I know there were some conversations around that in there, and I can't remember which, might have been in the random channel or something like that. The idea. Oh, okay. So I want to go back to this, right? Like the one true secure framework, because this came up multiple times during both B-sides. I think even on the panel, I think Clint mentioned, right? Like, oh, AI is going to get to the point where it's, you know, it's completely secure. And I had to push back a little. I love Clint, right? But I had to push back because I don't necessarily see this. There's going to be new mistakes. Yes, like maybe the gap will close. But the way that we use third-party software, the way that we use libraries, the way that we use dependencies, and we are having AI actually use those dependencies, supply chain exploits, supply chain vulnerabilities, what we're seeing today with Axios, which, you know, we're going to talk about here shortly, it's going to get worse before it gets better. You know, like just the fact that March has been supply chain attack hell, and yeah, like, let's be honest, right? Like between Axios and what were the other two that actually happened here pretty recently?
God, don't put me on the spot. I know, but I don't know.
There's
where
the
is
team
6 Mile PC, when you need PC, it?
Trivi was the one.
Trivi was one. Yeah.
Yep. Light LLM.
Wasn't that while we were at B-Sides or
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, because Paul was talking about it, right? Like, he was getting off the plane doing analysis in San Francisco as we got there for B-Sides for the Trivi one. Light right. LLM has happened, right? Like, so there's multiple open source packages that have been exploited within the last 2 weeks. There is a huge concentration. And if we go back to our predictions for 2025 and 2026, when we talk about supply chain security, this is exactly what we were focusing in on. If you can compromise a maintainer's account for one of these large packages, the blast radius is huge. And you are going, as an attacker, you're going to get access to more and more streams, more and more devices, more and more results, more and more CI/CD pipelines. Cleanup is going to be messy. So yes, you have a lot of organizations that are jumping on this, but as soon as you hit that mid-market, small market, guess what? Axios is probably, this is going to be an issue for years.
This is going to be, I mean, this is in everything. Axios is literally in everything.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, hey, did we mention what Axios is? Like, did we tell them it's like an HTTP
no.
client? Oh, it's an HTTP client. And like, yeah. It's just for, I mean, I would say it is the number one. I think, you know, it works really well. It really works well with like asynchronous sort of operations as well for making like a RESTful HTTP kind of client calls. So it's basically the underpins, you know, similar to HTTP client and other ecosystems, that it kind of underpins like most things. So it's just, yeah, you couldn't have chosen a better. What was really weird, by the way, was that the maintainer, and unless somebody has new information, the last time I was reading from both Paul McCarty and John Hammond's from Huntress blog posts on this, so open source malware Huntress, and nobody said that they, like, the maintainer was like, I have 2FA and MFA on everything. So they were pretty confused on how the actual, like, how their credentials were actually breached and then escalated on GitHub, they skipped GitHub's actions. Sorry, CI/CD pipeline. I guess they use, this was interesting too. So I guess they use OIDC in their actions build to publish the package, right? The Axios package. But apparently through the investigation, they realized they were also always sending an NPM token and to publish. And the NPM token was actually the credential. So NPM credentials were the only thing used to actually publish. And so therefore the OIDC configuration just was never used. So even though they took the time to do that, take those security precautions, it was actually misconfigured. And so not effective. And then I guess the actual package was published between, I want to say, it sounded like a little confused because the Huntress one had March 31st, which is impossible. And then Paul had it on March 30th as the compromise. And so what it looked like to me is that from Sunday, like my time, I'm on the East Coast, so maybe after 7 or 8 p.m. my time, it then looked like it went into maybe late hours of Monday morning, the attack. And then that was kind of the window for breach and if you were to update. And then I guess the other thing to mention is they had a post install script that so the Axios had a new dependency that it didn't import and didn't use. That new dependency had a post install script with it, which had a remote access Trojan. And I don't know. That's where my brain starts to forget the other details, but that in a nutshell is what it sounds like. But I'm curious, like, how his or her, I don't even know who the person was who manages Axios, but someone's credentials got compromised. They don't know.
Yeah. Her. Well, yeah. Cause it's interesting. Dual account compromise. So both the NPM and GitHub accounts.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is nuts.
Yeah. And then they, like, the other collaborator that was trying to respond didn't have admin access, so couldn't actually revoke permissions from that account, which caused it to, it took an extra 3 hours because they had to escalate it to NPM admin. Sorry, I'm just reading through Paul's write up on it here.
Yeah, well, did you see what... So Larry put in an interesting detail. After execution, the malware deletes itself and replaces its own package.json with a clean version to evade forensic detection, published via NPM CLI, bypassing normal CI/CD processes. Yeah, that's the main key, is it was published via the NPM CLI using an NPM token, not via the GitHub Actions CI/CD OIDC deploy setup that they had. It's from Paul's post. Okay.
Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. You're going to see these become more and more sophisticated, right? And part of it here is they are using Claude. They are using LLMs to improve the overall effectiveness of these attacks, right? Or you're using an LLM, whether or not Claude is going to actually shut that down. But to be honest, it probably won't, right? Like, so some of the talks that we saw at B-Sides specifically were talking about large language models from some of the foundation organizations, right? And they were talking about how long running conversations, guardrails fail over time, right? Yeah. So the guardrails that you put on an LLM, that the providers put on the LLM, are good for the first couple of interactions, but the longer that you maintain a session, the more that you can step over those guardrails, and all of these attackers have figured that out. So we have long-running sessions using things like Opus, like Sonnet, like the later versions of chat, you know, ChatGPT, the GPT-5.2, 5.3s, and there's nothing that they can really do about it. This is just the world that we live in now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm also reading Bobby's comment, but yeah, I was just trying to think of, like, I mean, all it takes is, you know, reusing a password somewhere, or, but I do think it's odd with 2FA, and I don't know, like, I'll be curious to see if somebody's able to dissect and break this down on how they were compromised, if they're properly protecting their account. That kind of, that's what worries me the most. But I mean, I guess in general, to what you were saying, I mean, you kind of, I'll just reiterate what you said already, which is just that, like, with these compromises and with developer tool sets being the way that they are now on local machines, if a local machine is compromised, like, it's going to be pretty nasty. It's going to be pretty rough. And yeah, I hate to say it, but AI tooling does, as we've seen already in 2025, it definitely speeds things up for exploitation, and the impact radius gets a much wider, much quicker than ever before. So,
yeah. And I mean, to Bobby's point as well, there was a comment that he put in a little bit ago, right? Like, secure code is the end goal, but there are many perfect, there's a lot of good code that's out there. When you have broken design architecture and you can't figure out what's a bug versus a feature, if you can't figure that out as a person, the LLM is going to struggle with it as well, and is going to default to, hey, this is good. This is part of the code itself. Oh, you meant to actually put SQL injection and RCE in here. Oh, you were exposing an endpoint that directly interacts with the database, and you expected SQL to come in, so this is okay. Like, that sort of thing is hard to determine without really, really defined specifications and expectations. And the same is going to go for the third-party libraries that are being used. And this gets back to that idea. I don't believe that there's going to be a one true secure framework that we're all going to use. If anything, and we're going to splinter at this point, and people are going to utilize the skills that they have and the fact that they can quickly prototype things to get off of third-party dependencies.
Yeah.
Right?
Oh man, there's a direction I could take the conversation. It's going to go way out there in left field.
So where do you think this line is? When does that happen? When do people actually, when do developers or organizations decide that the risk of open source software and third-party software is too great and decide to roll their own?
Hopefully not when it comes to crypto. Unless they're a crypto bunch of experts, and hopefully also not for authentication. I don't know. I will say this, like, obviously as security folks, we never rely on one thing, right? So that's my answer to pretty much anything that ever talks about one, whatever, one AI to secure it all, one framework to rule them all, one library that can fix whatever. I mean, it's just not realistic. It's never going to happen. And also, if like there's one chink in the armor of that one thing, then the whole model always falls down. So it's just not really sustainable. And I don't know how, but I started to what you made me think about was, I don't know how like I got through this circuitous path, but I was thinking about how you and I heard this weekend how maybe, oh, I think it's the combination of what you said plus Bobby's take on, like, even if code's perfect, architecture has to be sane. It made me start to think about like the ADLC, and even further, mm-hmm. like how some people were positing this weekend that, or this last week, that maybe the Git protocol goes, I heard that. Didn't you hear that as well? Like the Git protocol might go away. Pull requests themselves might go away. Like things just might be like, cause human attestation isn't working and people are, I don't know. It's like a immediate desire to throw the baby out with the bathwater. It seems like in favor of just everything being automatic and awesome. I don't know.
And that is the naive take, right? Like that's where we all started was, hey, we're going to use AI for everything. And we don't need to implement all of this. And what have we learned? Evaluations. We've got to combine deterministic with, generative, right? Like, or creative. We have to do observability because things go wrong. We have drift. We have other risks that are associated with it. So it doesn't necessarily happen that same way.
Or the one true framework, right? It's like we talk through that, but every time we talk through the one true framework, we get into this nuance, like there's many factors such as human beings, right? Like they don't want to use one thing to do all things. Also, one thing isn't the right answer for everything. It's like, I don't know. I always get a little like, why does this come up? You know, it still does. I mean, it came up at RSA and it came up at B-Sides and I'm always like, I don't see it ever happening. It seems like a pipe dream. Seems like a theoretical non-starter, you know, said never going to happen thing.
Honestly, right? Like the first time that we really had this discussion was early on in the podcast. I think the first time that Jim Manico came on the podcast, he posited that there was going to be one framework that solved cross-site scripting and everything, right? And we weren't going to have to worry about it ever again. And that was at this point, how many years ago? Right. Like that was early. That was probably 2018 that he came on the podcast.
Yeah. I was going to say it's probably 6-8 years ago, something like that. I don't know. Long time
ago. So people have been claiming this for a long time, right? Oh, well, we've got the new Java encoder project or whatever it is, right? Like from OWASP, and that's going to solve it. And it never does because to your point, people want to use different things. Bobby's Bobby's take on dependency upgrades, like that we should have more friction there, how infrequently we have to do it, right? Like we shouldn't be upgrading libraries constantly. Especially for sensitive systems, I'm with you. Yeah.
I agree with that.
There's got to be some analysis that goes on. I remember getting pushback when I was embedded in an organization as like a security architect, like in the ProdSec role, that the developers were pretty, they wanted to move a lot faster, right? But this was a financial and the organization just couldn't bear that risk. And so we had to approve basically every single change and every single dependency that was going into the pipeline. But now you look at it, and that would have saved this organization specifically and a lot of organizations from Axios, from a lot of these like trivia, like any sort of dependency that gets injected into the CI/CD pipeline would have had to go through this approval process. It's going to catch this sort of stuff, right? Like, but that's, again, we're going back to human and expert in the loop style decision making. That doesn't necessarily align with the ADLC, this idea that the AI can actually do everything as quickly as possible. Anyway, yeah, I don't know, right?
I just want to, there is something that's, it's a little problematic because, this is weird. Cause like, I was just thinking about what if I did have approval for certain libraries, right? Or even if I didn't. Even if I had an automated, like, you know, we have an automated policy thing that checks like every pull request to see if your dependencies are introducing known CV dependencies with known CVs. But that the problem is that those CVs are like your package.
Where's
is going to
be up.
Well, when it's silent, right? When you don't know yet and there isn't a CV assigned. So I could theoretically approve a library that seems fine, you know, like Axios is like, why wouldn't I approve that? I probably would put that on auto approval. I'd be like, well, we use that everywhere. Like, of course, you know? And then what happens is like when that 7 or 8 hour or however long it was window hits, it's like, granted this was like a late Sunday night on this particular one, but yeah, it's not a foolproof. It's not really foolproof yet, unfortunately. There is the concept though of staged, artifact servers, right? Where you have a cushion between what's happening in the wild and your buffered sort of gapped, time gapped, air gap, not air gap, time gapped library server. But you know, that comes down to budget, people to manage it. You know, you're required, you know, are you going to be able to actually do that, right? Like, meaning will the engineers be okay with that? Lots of factors.
Mm-hmm.
So where's our silver bullet, Seth? Where's the silver bullet? How do we fix this forever and ever and all time?
Go. Go. Unplug all your systems. Yeah.
Dude, that didn't even take 3 seconds. That's a perfect answer. All your systems.
Learn how to farm. I don't know, right? Like, yeah.
That's looking better by the day. That's looking better by the day, my guy. Yeah. Probably stink at it.
For sure. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah. Maybe let's move on. Here's some more like nihilistic takes, right? This from sockpuppet.org. Everybody's pretty negative, right? Like, again, like we were on the positive side at like B-sides or whatever, and now this sort of stuff is happening. Sockpuppet.org yesterday put out this blog, vulnerability research is cooked.
I'll put it in Slack. You don't have to worry about that.
Okay. So this in general, right? They posit, based on the last couple of years, like we've been saying for a while, and maybe just I'll share out this screen here as we talk through it, that so technologists, even us, right? Like, we predicted that AI coding agents were responsible for a deluge of security vulnerabilities. We've seen this happen kind of across the industry, from bug bounty results and reports that are going in there to everything that's being generated on pull requests and everything else. There's quite a few more, or there's a lot more content that's being generated, especially from a vulnerability perspective, but it's also a lot of high impact vulnerability research that's happening. Just go look at like Reddit NetSec nowadays. The number of vulnerabilities and CVEs that are being reported have increased significantly, right? And a lot of that research is really pretty good. And usually what's happening is there's a person directing an LLM to go in and do very, very targeted analysis on open source projects, on different repositories. They're finding something that's interesting. They're figuring out exploit paths. Something that would have taken 2 to 3 years of research is now taking 1 to 2 months with expert level interactions to actually validate what's going on there. And so Sock Puppet is basically saying that vulnerability research in general is cooked, right? Talking about their experience, you know, in the 90s with all of the Stack Overflow exploits, Unix system crash dumps, right? Like everything else that's in there. But the price has gone down for actually doing this sort of analysis because of the LLMs that exist. They're skilled at software development. They're skilled at identifying these things. And the number of vulnerabilities that Opus was able to generate and validate as high severity do lead into this. All right. So, I mean, I think that's kind of enough about the thesis or the TLDR on this. What is your feelings as far as vulnerability research goes, right? Like, we don't necessarily talk about this too much on the AppSec ProdSec side of things, since this kind of goes to low level vulnerability research. But how do you feel? Do you think that vulnerability research is cooked in this case, is done, both from a bug bounty perspective and from a just underlying code perspective?
I'm actually still trying to catch up on this one. Because I'm trying to understand, as he said, like, there's this person, whoever they are, made a statement about pricing. was trying to understand. So the price and everyone's cost of doing this. Okay.
Yeah.
It seems like this is geared towards elite level, whatever that means, elite level vulnerability research. But then I don't know if that's true, because then they mentioned things like, well, you know, the LLM is trained on frameworks. So it's got knowledge of Rails unmarshaling serialization vulnerabilities. I'm like, yeah, but I think everybody knows about that's not like elite level. You know what I mean? That's just a bug. It's just a, or if you're using that with user input and you're not doing anything, it's just a bug. I don't know. I'm still trying to separate out some of this. Cause yeah, like they make some points about agents being able to loop through tasks and how, you're vulnerable. I mean, one thing that I agree with here is that they mentioned that vulnerabilities kind of pop up in areas you wouldn't expect. So like, you know, they use the, well, it's not just like where your password's being stored, but it's like where all of the input goes and is used in weird ways that you couldn't have expected. And, you know, that's the whole point behind fuzzing. And they're just basically saying the agents can, without taking a break, without, you know, getting frustrated, whatever, they can go down all the rabbit holes and automate a lot of that work.
I guess. So the last paragraph here does a good job of kind of succinctly stating where he's going, right? He thinks we're living in the last fleeting moments where there's any uncertainty that AI agents will supplant most human vulnerability research. So he's saying that in the vulnerability research space, AI agents will take over from what humans have done up to this point.
Oh, this is Thomas Pichet. Really, sorry, I didn't see this.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah.
I would have to agree, right? Like I posted this recently, right? And this was a kudos to you and your team, right? Like using DeepScan, where we're doing a code review in like an application that has, you know, dozens of roles and dozens of permissions, where it would take a human, like somebody like me on my team, a good 3 days to actually parse through everything that's there, identify where each of the, you know, with the permission boundaries are actually set and figure that out. But with an AI agent, DeepScan in this case, actually perusing the code, they identified within, you know, 30 minutes that there was a flaw and privilege escalation was possible. We confirmed, and within 2 hours, we had uncovered a very critical exploit for a client that would not have been apparent without real brute forcing on our side of the code itself, and even making sure that we went down the right rabbit hole when we were looking at the code. And that's the argument that he's making here, is that the analysis that we've done for the last 20 years as humans is becoming the purview of AI agents. So if you're dependent on a human doing that for your research, for your funding, whatever it is, expect that that's going to change.
Why does it have to supplant? That's the term you use, Thomas. You use supplant as the word. That's, I don't know if that's accurate, man. I do think like
there's still a place. Yeah. Okay. So finish your thought.
Yeah, I would just say that it's like, why put it this way? When Burp Suite came out, we were able to spider all the endpoints on an application and figure out what, you know, what they look like when it's a normal request versus a non-normal request, and you know, immediately had like sequencer able to help us understand if like a token was weak crypto, or if we had compare, and we could, you know, all these things that help us speed up our work. And we used to write scripts to do ourselves. Like that didn't change fundamentally our role. And don't get me wrong, I understand that this is different because it's, you know, these agents and whatnot can do operations that are perform operations that are much more complex. But again, at the end of the day, look, I guess maybe it's just because I work with these systems so deeply every single day that I just don't have the faith that everybody else has. I have a belief that it will definitely speed things up, that it will definitely get you through the 99.9% of things that you would have discovered and that,
yeah,
you know, would have taken you a lot of time. But I don't think it should be a, well, and yeah, granted, right, one day, maybe in 20 years or whatever, it, maybe I sound stupid for saying this, but as of right now, I think the humans still, there's still a place for us. Very much so. I think these are helping automate our workflow like any other tool, but just in a deeper way. But there's still, again, I would never fully go hands off. I just wouldn't.
Yeah.
I see the reality of how they work under the hood and how much it takes to get them to not do things incorrectly and stay on track and have repeat. Yeah. Anyways, all the things they always talk about.
Mm-hmm. No, I'm with you there, right? Like, I mean, obviously, right? Like, cause that's what I, you know, I've built our business on is being the human that's actually there and, you know, available for that sort of thing. I did love this paragraph or this statement from him though, is most exploit development isn't new science, right? Like most of the vulnerabilities that we identify are known issues, right? Like that's the point of the OWASP ASVS. That's the point of the OWASP top 10. And we're just going to get better at that, you know. But the deep insight sometimes is a factor, and that's where we're going to be pushed as humans is the deep insight. The things that it's going to be difficult for an LLM to know, whether that's context of a company across the board, different like processes, internal, whatever it is, like they'll get better at it as we direct it. But there's always going to be that element of how it's actually being directed. So a lot of the vulnerabilities that we identify that are impactful is because of what he says here, determination, luck, incentive, basic programming and debugging skill, and conversance with the literature, reading the documentation, right? So he spent 15 years getting paid to find and exploit vulnerabilities, and the most impactful findings tended to be the boring ones, right? He's not wrong.
Yeah, he's not wrong, but there's another factor to all this, which is like LLMs have to be trained on something, right? So what I was thinking about is like, as these, you know, let's talk about the scenario 10, 15, 20 years down the road from now. Well, the technology has changed even in the last, you know, I would say 3 years is about 3 to 4 years within that timeline is about when AI in its current form LLMs really started to kind of make a dent. So even since then, there has been new ecosystem things released, right? There have been, right? And I think if we project out in 15 or 20 years, which is what I would think it would take to completely annihilate any human research, well, in that time, you'll have put together new systems. And yeah, it's totally possible those new systems have the same old, they usually do, right? They always do. We never seem to learn from ourselves. So they'll probably have some of the same old flaws, whether it's architectural or little things that, like he said, little bugs that are common but high impact, sure, but there will also still be a need for new, like when LLMs came out, well, then people went deep into not just prompt injection but all the ways that you, I mean, we have a whole agentic top 10 from OWASP because of this. I don't think that security research will have, LLMs have to be trained, the security research has to be made for the LLMs to, unless we get to a world like, I mean, that's the AGI promise, right? It's novel, new, innovative, it making things up on its own, things that never existed, right? That's totally a possibility. I'm just saying that in the absence of that, which I don't see for a little bit, you need human beings to feed the LLMs this new research. So it's kind of a silly argument, because otherwise, yeah, they won't work. They won't have that research in them, they won't know that that's a problem to go look for.
Yeah.
They're not magic.
Yeah.
Yeah. Hey, I know we don't have time to get to it today. So I'm just going to drop this link since we're at the hour minimum. I'm going to drop this link for the impact report for folks. Maybe next week we can talk about it or not. It doesn't really matter. But there is a 40 page, I'm only halfway through it, actually a little less, 40 page impact report from OWASP with Andrew Vanderstock on the giving his executive sort of, you know, overview of what the impact report is and all that fun stuff. So post it in chat.
Sweet. I'll have to take a look at it. I haven't even started into it yet. So, all right. Well, yeah, we've gone for more than an hour. I always feel like these fly by. Thank you so much for interacting today. Always great to see Larry and Bobby, you know, hear their thoughts on things as well. And yeah, I know we've got guests that are coming up. It's going to be, you know, a lot over the next couple of weeks, the next month. Ken and I will be out next week because we are going to be teaching next Tuesday. But if you are in Omaha for KernelCon, please hit us up. I'd love to go grab drinks or whatever else. And yeah, any final thoughts before we close it out today?
No. Sorry. Yeah, I don't know. Good job, Seth, and keep up the good work.
Something like keep, that.
Keeping All right. on. Keeping on.
Keep on keeping on. Sweet. All right. Thanks, all. We will see you soon. See you online.
Thank you.